Wait.
All right. Well, let's do this. Welcome to the Bass and Treble Podcast. My name is Neil.
And I'm Steve.
You are. And this week, we are going to talk about one of the best albums in the history of albums, Abbey Motherfucking Road. Cover your ears, kids. Oh, wait, too late. If you don't know what we're talking about, you could just get the hell out of here, unsubscribe, and don't ever listen to us again.
Well, you don't have to go that far, but it would help if you know some Beatles.
That's right.
After we talk about the Beatles, we're going to talk about some stuff that happened this week in music history.
I like stuff.
This week's sucky song of the day is guaranteed to get stuck in your head for the rest of the week.
I can't stop thinking about it right now. It's so catchy. It's kind of like herpes. If you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and check us out on iTunes and SoundCloud or on our website, which Steve made himself, bassandtreblepodcast.com.
Or you can find us on Facebook at Bass and Treble, or you can find us on Twitter at Bass Treble Pod for all sorts of fun content.
Yep, definitely. We'll have some weird stuff there. So this week, Steve, you picked the album. It was your pick. It was your suggestion. I think we did kind of a pick by committee, but I think this is an excellent pick, and it takes us way, way back in the day. So why did you pick Abbey Road? Do I even have to ask why, or just go over Abbey Road? You don't need to explain why you picked it.
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of the most classic albums of all time when you're talking about classic albums. It's the best album by the best band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was kind of waiting a while before we pulled this out, but I think it's about time.
That's what she said.
It somehow crams 17 memorable tracks into something like 47 minutes.
Wow.
And every moment of this album is special.
Released September 26th of 1969, just 1 month after their last performance. This was released right in the heat of it all, 1969.
Yeah, this was the end of the Beatles as we know it. This is the last album that they recorded together in the studio. And they kind of knew it, and I think there's a lot of themes and a lot of moments in this album where the band kind of knew, like, all right, this is our last chance to make something good. I think they were just getting out of the Let It Be sessions and the Get Back sessions, and there was a lot of fighting amongst themselves, and they were having a lot of problems, and then they just decided, you know what, let's just go back to the way it used to be. Let's make one more like we used to. I think we're Paul McCartney's exact words when he was talking to the producer George Martin, and you could feel it.
Yeah, George Martin, which was kind of creepy and really, really loved them a little too much, I would say, but definitely wanted to make this last one. You know, this album is kind of them gathering scraps of material they'd piled up over time, and I think between McCartney and Martin, they pieced together a song title that was just that's just bursting with light and a whole lot of optimism. It really is kind of a, for me, it's my favorite Beatles album, and really, like you said already, one of the top albums ever if you just listen to it front to back, which is perfect for this podcast to review.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it definitely kind of got away from all the bad vibes from the previous 2 years. It's funny that we know that the Beatles' first album, Please Please Me, had come out almost exactly 6.5 years earlier, and that's like their first album coming out in 2009 today. So we talk about the greatest band ever. Man, that's a pretty quick run, and boy, did they change in those 6.5 years.
That's right. You think about where they started with their Please Please Me sessions. They were like little kids running around. They were just like full of energy and doing all sorts of, you know,
mop tops and matching suits. And
then just 6.5 years later, they matured into, you know, the mature, sage, lots of drug. Actually, they were past their drug phase at this point. Well, I don't know if they ever really grew out of their drug phase.
I think they're still in their drug phase, and I want to take back their mop tops went away, because Ringo always had a mop top, except for like recently, where he looks like Bono's cool uncle nowadays. But definitely a short stint to come out from first to last album, and it is their best-selling album. So if you want to say it's best and best-selling.
Yeah, this album has sold more than any other Beatles album ever.
But you want to have some stat to be like, more than the first combined! But no, we don't know all that. All we know is that it's a best album in our eyes and best selling. So I guess those usually go hand in hand, but not always. Not always with every band.
I think it's their most selling album for a bunch of reasons. It's the last piece of recorded material you can get. I mean, they had, you know, some plenty of stuff that came out after this. They had Let It Be, and they had the anthologies, and they had the Greatest Hits album. But, you know, this is their last studio recordings, and I think there was a lot of people that wanted to get their hands on it for that reason. But also that, it's just filled with great music. You put the songs on here, and, you know, Beatles have some up songs and down songs. And
exactly.
You know, this is a great combination of all sorts of emotions crammed into one album. And even the two sides, you can kind of tell the difference. Side one is a bunch of individual tracks. Almost all of the second side is one big, long medley. They fit right. Nine separate songs just kind of rolled into each other, maybe a minute or two at a time, for about 16 minutes altogether. And each song could totally stand up on their own.
Definitely. And we're going to get into all that. But first...
Neil, did you know if you say Abbey Road backwards three times into a mirror at midnight, a silver hammer will come down on your head?
I did not know that, but did you know that Octopus's Garden was originally named Squid's Garden, but Paul threatened to change his name to Paulita if they didn't change it to Octopus's Garden?
I thought everybody knew that.
I didn't.
George Harrison died in 2001. Or did he? Rumor has it that he's chilling out on a private bungalow in Fiji.
With Tupac.
I'm on a mission to prove it myself. My flight takes off at 0800 hours.
Well, have fun going to Fiji. Make sure you get the water there. I hear it's local and cheap. So, starting off with the first track on this album, Side Uno, the first track is Come Together. And who cannot think of all of the interesting lyrics John Lennon put together for this song? Like, he's got Muddy Water, and he got Mojo Filter, and it's a blues track. It's a real kind of standardy blues track that I think starts off the album cool, because it's so mysterious and silky in its bluesness. I would imagine at the time people were like, whoa, this is different.
I mean, I kind of get the idea. It says come together, like right now, over Steve.
It's over me, but okay.
What are they trying to say? Like, what's the whole purpose? I understand the whole come together part, but like in between, like you said, it's just a lot of like mumbo jumbo.
It's blues, man. It doesn't have to make all the sense in the world. I think this is one of those, they're just having fun. Ringo's drums were very... I guess interesting, not a typical blues sound, like all the cool little things was going on. I don't know what the hell this song's about. I think this kind of sounds like it could have been following up to kind of that Sgt. Pepper feel of like, you're talking about a dude who's got some kind of magic powers, and when he says come together over me, I don't know. Like, I have zero theory over this song, and I'm sure that there's a bunch of different theories of it or a real story to what it's about, but I can't think of any. Like, it's very bizarre.
One thing I can say about this song is that twice this week with different groups of friends, I played the game of which songs do you like better in their cover version than the original?
Oh, no.
And Aerosmith does the version of Come Together.
Oh, we're going to disagree.
Which can compete. I'm not going to
Aerosmith is
better than the Beatles.
I hate the Aerosmith cover of this song just because the way Steven Tyler sings, like, in modo sado, I'm like, oh, shut the up. Like, this is a...
Yeah, but that's Steven Tyler's style. That's what Aerosmith is all about. They run the blues just as much.
The guitar in the Aerosmith version, because I love Joe Perry so much, I really do. The guitar in it is definitely, I would say, better, but the singing is just like... Steven Tyler is to rock what Metallica is to metal. That you just don't have to say the words like this. Why are you doing this? So yeah, I don't know. I just don't like his singing in it. What does he say? He's like when he says, oh no psycho, he's like, oh no psycho. It's like everything has to sound like so much more bluesy. And Steven Tyler's a great blues singer, so I guess he pulls it off well. But no, yeah, I agree.
I think he's got the style. He could do it.
They play the cover more than the original, so there is that. So the next song is Something, which is... I like to call it, in Spanish, it's what's called a Baja Panties song.
I know enough Spanish to know what that means. If you don't know, look it up.
Dude, I used to play just the beginning notes of this and sing Something in the Way at a gig, and you hear people go, "Ah!" It's like so hilarious. Song.
Even Frank Sinatra, he recorded it twice. He said it was the greatest love song of the past 50 years.
I have to look that up and see if he sang it slower or faster.
I would love to hear a Sinatra version of this song. It's the sweetest song.
I would love to hear like a Sinatra upbeat version of this. Like really corny. Actually, no, that's probably the Tony Bennett version. Do you even know who Tony Bennett is, Steve?
What kind of question is that? Come on, I know that guy who just did that album with Lady Gaga.
That's the only reason you know him, right? Like, nobody knew Tony Bennett behind
him. No, he also had an MTV Unplugged, like, probably 15 years ago.
All right, we're getting off topic. Fuck Tony Bennett. So, what do you think of Something?
It's a beautiful song. And every time George Harrison has credits on a song, I feel like I have to point it out. Like, Lennon and McCartney are, like, the two, you know, head figures of the Beatles. But Harrison had some hits, too, and this is one of them. I love it.
I mean, I've said it before on this podcast, but it's well-known fact in music lore that in the early years of the Beatles, between Paul and the rest of their production team, he was at times told exactly what notes to play. He had very little free rein as a lead guitarist to express himself. And so I agree, man. When there's a song with his name's credits on it, a Beatles song, you have to point it out. But this one especially has some really beautiful stuff going on. It has some really nice key changes. Has that silky little guitar solo by itself, which it just makes me think like, oh, I guess I know where the Chili Peppers and John Frusciante get all their inspiration for guitar solos.
Wow. That's
you
a
know?
Great comparison right there. I totally see it.
Think of Californication, right? Californication has the same kind of thing going on. There's a little break, and then it's by itself, builds up. And, yeah, wonderful, wonderful song. Track 3, Maxwell's Silver Hammer. This song has such a neat Wurlitzer keyboard sound in it. All that woo, blue, 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 all that interesting stuff going on. It's so badass. The lyrics are something else. Isn't this like a song about a teacher or something?
Yeah, it's a song about, I think, a kid named Maxwell. And he goes around and anything that he doesn't like, he just puts a silver hammer through people's heads.
So which one of the Beatles is Maxwell? Probably Paul, right?
he does have credits on this song, so I could say that's a safe bet.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, for this song, I want to give a quick shout out to my friends Matt and Summer for naming their kid Maxwell after Maxwell Silverhammer.
Really?
Yeah. I always kind of think of Thor in my head when I think of Maxwell and his Silverhammer. I see Thor and his hammer. I kind of see Maxwell being a Thor-like figure.
True. I always think of my drummer, Max, that's not even his real name. His stage name is Maxwell Ames. And I think he just named it to kind of sound like a porn star. Because Maxwell is a real porn star.
Sounds very, like, high society British. Yeah.
Maxwell Ames, you know what his real name is? I'll just let it out. His real name is Paul. So
if anyone wants to look it up, your cover is blown, yeah. Dude.
Whatever. So you owe somebody money. But when she turns it back on the boy, he creeps up from behind. Bang, bang, Maxwell Silver came down on her head.
So the next track after Maxwell's Silver Hammer is Oh Darlin'.
The hardest song to sing in human history.
Even for Paul. Oh. I mean, he would actually make it to the studio 30 minutes before they were supposed to record and try to lay down the vocal tracks first thing in the morning because he had that early morning raspy voice that he was looking for. He said he wanted it to sound as though he'd been performing on stage all week.
I love the part of it is so sick. And it sounds like a Christmas song. Every time I think of Oh Darling, I think it should be played around the holidays. That guitar, that meow, like it sounds like a Christmas song. It's got little, the way the chord changes are. It's a song about losing a girl. right?
Yeah, talking about being left behind. And, dude, have you ever seen the movie Across the Universe?
I haven't. I know you have, and I should have seen it by now, and I've never seen it because it's a musical, and I generally don't like them, even if they are people I like.
But it's not just a regular musical. It's a Beatles musical. All the characters in there, they were named after Beatles characters. We'll get into a bunch of stuff there. But there's a version of Oh Darlin' on there, which is incredible. They pull it off really well. Like you're saying, it's a really
hard one
to sing and get that vocal quality. Yeah. But they pull it off in such a way. And there's this back and forth between the characters that's happening during this song that just makes it memorable.
Man, I had a buddy of mine that could play the lead guitar for this and sing the whole thing. That beep, 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 and pull off singing it. And every time he did it, I was like... Wow, that's like impressive. You deserve a break now. Go have a beer. It's just enough singing to put you over the top. I love that song a lot. It's really neat. It's got a lot of cool parts in it. That's one thing about this Beatles album in particular. It's not very repetitive. I think Come Together is probably the most repetitive out of the songs we covered so far, but Oh Darlin' has a lot of cool different things that kind of build on top of each other.
I think even more so when you get to this second side of the album. You're right, there's no time for anything to repeat. Everything just blasts right through, you know, 2-3 minutes at a time.
Damn right. And then, the next track, Octopus's Garden, which is pretty much the same exact chord changes as Sublime Santeria. If you put them side by side, it's the same thing.
Really?
Yeah. Just listen to them one and the other, and you'll be like, oh, wow. Other than some extra stuff Octopus Garden does, I've been able to pull off Octopus's Garden, that intro, and go right into Santeria. It's the same exact chord changes. But talking about Octopus Garden and the Beatles, what... a cool throwback to Yellow Submarine. They're back underwater. I think for being the last album they recorded, that's a cool touch to throw in a song to kind of, I guess, part of their repertoire is talking about being under the ocean and shit. And I love the lyrics in this song. We will be warm under the storm and a little higher wave beneath the waves.
Yeah, it's a perfect song for little kids. You know, you think about all the little kid-friendly stuff that the Beatles put together. This one is just like having a good time while you're under the sea with all your octopus friends.
Yeah, definitely. It's a happy song, but it could also kind of be interpreted a little darker, I think.
How's that?
The whole song kind of makes it seem like they're trying to run away from the world by being underwater. We could sing and laugh out loud because we know we can't be found. We could be so happy, you and me. No one there to tell us what to do. A lot of it is just kind of like, let's get away from responsibilities. It's a little more than just have fun. It's like, responsibilities suck. Let's go to our octopus's garden.
All right, good point.
Which, by the way, what is an octopus's garden?
You know, it's where he tends to his anemones and coral reefs.
I don't know if an octopus has any enemies, Steve, but I'll let you ride with that one.
So another interesting point about Octopus's Garden, this is a Ringo Starr song. So at this point, we're 5 tracks in, and we've given all 4 of the Beatles a chance to shine.
Wow, that's so cool.
We would shout and swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves.
And then the next track is I Want You, She's So Heavy, which is a song about a girl who's overweight. No, I'm kidding. She's So Heavy. Every time they sing that, I always think, like, she's so heavy, does that mean that she's so dark? She's so goth?
I always thought of it kind of like Marty McFly heavy. It's like back in the 50s, it was a slang term to use, like, whoa, man, that's heavy.
Oh, yeah. Here, see? She's a heavy dame. She's got lots of brains. I'm not sure I've ever heard that before, but I love how this song turns into... this cool kind of Santana guitar stuff going on, you know? It's like, it really is very Santana-like. This song is almost kind of that, in that mold. And I think this is right around the time, maybe a year after Santana, but it has definitely that cool little boo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, that cool little moving bass line. And then it goes into these crazy, crazy parts. It's like Lennon, whatever the heck is going on. I think that was actually Paul doing that. Did you know that Paul McCartney and Harry Nilsson used to get into like screaming battles in the studio?
It's not surprising.
Yeah, Harry Nilsson actually ruined his voice because of it, and had to, like, his career ended short because he would mess around too much with Paul McCartney and do too much coke and like sing too loud.
If there's any lesson that you should take away from that right there, is that you don't challenge the Beatles. They will win every time and you will be left without a career.
Yeah, don't make friends with the Beatles. It'll ruin your life. And so you have some cool themes in this song too. I want you so bad, it's driving me mad. This song, that kind of whole period makes me think a little bit of like Helter Skelter. It's a little just kind of like screamy and out there. But then it goes into these really neat guitar segments where it's like smooth guitar soloing and moving bass line. It's such a cool song. Like, it's, I don't know, it's like goth on one hand and then it's like Spanish rock on the other. It's really interesting.
It's also droning. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on.
At the end it does.
I understand they kind of want to close out the last track on side one, but it goes on for almost 8 minutes long, just with the same beat over and over and over again until the record stops.
So yeah, I don't think that's anything new to end a side for them to kind of make it long and long and long. But that's okay. I think if you let it ride out, it's good. And then we hop into side two, which starts off with one of my favorite songs of all time, if anything, because it kind of makes me sad. It makes me a little emotional. Here Comes the Sun.
Really? It brings me happiness and joy. It reminds me of springtime after winter is over. And springtime comes around, the sun starts coming out a little bit later at night, and all the snow melts away. This reminds me of one of my favorite times of year.
There's a couple of Beatles songs that make me this way. Here Comes the Sun is one. The other one that is You and Me. You and Me always makes me sad. I don't know why. There's a theme to returning to normalcy that makes me think about when someone writes a song like this, Here Comes the Sun. I don't think they're in a good place. I think when they write a song like this, it's like they're writing it therapeutically. Maybe that's just me. And I don't know the story behind what it's written.
It's like... it's a hopeful song.
Right, there's a lot of hope in it. You're right.
Yeah, the darkness is over. The dark days are done. And you got the sun and brightness and fun times to look forward to.
Yep, absolutely. And then, speaking of songs that were covered better, the second song on side two is Because.
Well, Because starts out this whole medley. The next nine songs flow into each other. I think we knock out the next nine songs in about 16 minutes. And it all starts with Because.
Yeah, well, I really like the version on Beatles Love that's no music, just them singing.
Because the harmonies are amazing.
I also challenge you to time when the vocals will come back in, because it's not a normal time signature.
I see what you're saying.
They have these weird pauses where it's like, ah, and then you're like, ah.
It's almost like they're holding their breath in between each one. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's phenomenal. And it really, when you listen to it without the music, even though the music is amazing and especially the horn stuff going on,
right.
But you really get a sense for how beautiful the Beatles' voice is. You know, contrary to the sucky song of the day, of the week from last episode, this is what it sounds like when the Beatles all sing in unison. It's their angels, to quote Steve. They sound like freaking angels in this song.
Angelic.
Love is all, love is you.
Love is old, love is new.
Then You Never Give My Money, I guess, inspired ODB. That's just a joke.
Hey, dirty, you never give me your money.
I honestly, of all the songs on the album, I can't say this is one I can pin off the top of my head. It might be one that I kind of skip.
It's the longest song on this side, coming in at just about 4 minutes. And I don't know what to say about it either.
Yeah.
We could probably pass. We could probably skip this one pretty quickly.
Yeah. And then, so the next song, Sun King, this is where I think is actually where it starts. Like you said, Because starts it. I think You Never Give Me My Money is like a, is not following in tune after Because.
It's a song that stands on its own.
Yeah, Sun King, and there's, if you look online, anybody listening for like Sun King melody, it's a combination of Sun King, Mean Mr. Mustard, Polythene Pam, and She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. Those four is what people try to call the Sun King melody. But I think from here on out, from Sun King all the way, well, to the end, is kind of a really, I mean, it's an amazing chunk of music that just weaves in and out.
These are all the scraps from the previous sessions that they just kind of wanted to get out there and put it together, and each one of these songs could have stood on their own.
Yeah, it's like almost concept album-y after Sun King, and Sun King has such a sweet little arpeggiated guitar, that and the French words and stuff. It's a sexy-ass song. And then it goes right into Mean Mr. Mustard, which has some of the coolest ass lyrics ever. His sister Pam works in the shop. She never stops. She's a go-getter.
The lyrics almost come together like a Dr. Seuss rhyme.
Yeah. And it has this cool like carnival piano thing going on. Like bop, 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 bop. It's very
kind of
bombastic. Yeah, then it's funny because she talks about his sister Pam, then it goes into Polythene Pam, who's so good looking that she looks like a man, which can always get you. What's happening? And then right into She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, which is a very weird place for her to come through.
Although, going back to that movie Across the Universe, there is a scene where one of the main characters comes into the party house, the apartment, through the bathroom window. And it's subtle. She's just like, hey, all of a sudden, hey, guys, I'm here. But if you watch her actually enter into the scene, she comes in through the bathroom window. And unless
That's
you knew
funny,
any better...
It's usually a tiny little window, like above the shower. It's not a very big window to come through.
But see, the movie is filled with tiny, subtle little hints like that, where if you know what you're talking about, then it makes it that much more enjoyable.
All right, Steve. All right. I'll freaking watch it as soon as we're done here.
All right, cool. Thanks. Appreciate it.
I just want to say that the She Came In Through the Bathroom Window has some really interesting lyrics, which always stick with me. Like, she could steal, but she could not rob. It makes that distinction of what stealing is versus robbing. Like, stealing is one thing. Robbing is a whole other thing. And then Sundays on the phone to Mondays. Tuesdays on the phone to me. What does that mean? That's a lyric in there. Sundays on the phone to Monday. Tuesdays on the phone to me.
I think it's better if we don't dive too deep into the meaning of a lot of these. I don't think we're going to get
any
answers.
Any?
We're going down a dead end road.
Right. Then Golden Slumbers, not to be confused with Golden Showers, R. Kelly's.
Yeah, please don't confuse that. Golden Slumbers is a perfect bedtime song. And at this point, I think the album starts winding down a little bit.
Right.
This is where they start, you know, they have just a few tracks left on their last recording session. It's almost like they're putting their band to sleep. Golden Slumbers.
And I will sing a lullaby.
It is a lullaby.
And I will sing a lullaby.
Yeah, Carry That Weight is the next song.
This is a song that they all wrote together. They all kind of put their heads together and came up with this track.
My opinion of it, it's kind of, I don't know, it's an okay song. I like the lyrics in it, but it's very, it almost is like getting to the end, which the end starts off really weird. It could have been the beginning of a song as the next track, because it starts off with those, oh yeah, all right, are you gonna be in my dream tonight? And it has those cool drum fill things.
Yeah, Ringo never had done a drum solo before, and I think he was never really interested in it, but again, realizing that this was probably going to be their last album, he's like, all right, I could throw 15 seconds of a little drum break in here after some pushing and prodding from the rest of the band.
Well, Ringo is underrated in the Beatles. I've met many a drummer who says that Ringo is actually a really, really amazing drummer that complements the band really well. And I think he doesn't have like all the best chops in the world. He's not John Bonham or, you know, freaking Neil Peart, but he's definitely in the pocket and makes everything sound wonderful around him. And I love the ending of the end with all of its majesty and glory, and the lyric, and in the end, the love you make is equal to the love you take, or, right? No, in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
The love you make. Yeah, that is some sage wisdom advice that has been used in many different cases since.
Yeah, sage advice that they didn't provide us from Mean Mr. Mustard all the way to She Came Into the Bathroom Window. They make up for it in the end by having...
It was from making no sense at all to like the most profound note that Paul McCartney has ever mentioned. And then the album's over. Or is it?
No, it's got a little 23-second, what I like to call a little acoustic jammy jam. That's Her Majesty. I could probably sing the whole thing right now. And again, this, and I know that the Chili Peppers are huge Beatles fans. This makes me think of their Red Hot, which was a Robert Johnson cover at the end of their album. I think a lot of this album and Blood Sugar Sex Magik kind of make me think that they were on that kind of the same groove or same vibe, trying to make a really cool conceptual album with a lot of different things. But I love the lyric. I want to tell that I love her so, but I got a belly belly full of wine.
I think we've all been in that situation that. Before.
This song was supposed to be
right in between Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. But it was about to be scrapped. McCartney was like, you know what, I don't like this at all. It just doesn't fit. And he had it removed. But it turns out one of the engineers, he was told before, don't throw anything away, ever. So he's like, you know what, I'm going to throw it back in there about 20 seconds after the last track. And it was kind of literally a hidden track. And it made it to the final tape. So after Paul McCartney heard it, he finally realized, kind of worked in that context. And it stayed there forever. That's the end of the album.
So, Steve, what's your verdict? What's your verdict of this album? I think I know what you're going to say.
I think there's no way around it. This gets a double yay. I mean, if we're still using the scale of a yay, double nay.
It's a hey.
This gets a hey with four A's. I'm just going to keep that yay.
Steve, your voice is too deep to actually sound gay. Any gay subtleties with you have to be overtly gay jokes.
No, this is undisputed one of the best albums of all time. If you don't like Abbey Road, then you don't like the Beatles. And if you don't like the Beatles, you're just wrong.
I double agree with you. I square your yays, and together we have double yay.
Okay, let me spin this on
A's.
You. What's your least favorite part about the album? If we're sitting here saying that every moment is perfect and every moment is like specifically carved out for some purpose, then let's flip it and tell me what you don't like.
You Never Give Me Your Money. I don't think I ever liked that song. I think that they put it in there because Followed by Sun King is just two kind of mellow tracks. But that song, I just, it's just not all there for me. And Carry That Weight is also one that's kind of like, I mean, I know it's just a minute 36, but it's just them kind of singing together in kind of a boisterous drinking song manner, which I never really liked too much. So those two songs are the only two that I say are kind of maybe throwaway. Even Her Majesty has more of a place in my heart than those two. What is your low point of the album as well, to counter your question, my good man?
I'm going to go with Sun King on this one. All these other songs
I grew up with,
all these other songs I knew from, you know, from the time I was a kid. But Sun King, I think it wasn't until the Cirque du Soleil album came out, when there's a backwards version and they play Sun King backwards, and it didn't sound familiar whatsoever. So then I go ahead and look back up, and it turns out there was this song on this album the whole time. It just totally went under my radar. So when I finally heard it, I'm like, there can't be anything special to this song if I've heard everyone around it except for this one. So just because it never really struck a chord with me to begin with, I like to pretend like it never exists.
Yeah, I think if you look at Sun King down to Golden Slumbers, Sun King is like the waking up. It even has some sounds in it of like crickets and stuff. Sun King is kind of like you're waking up in the morning, and Golden Slumbers is that you're going to sleep.
I've always thought that Sun King had to do with staying up all night. Almost like the Doors song, Waiting for the Sun.
Waiting for the Sun.
I kind of make a reference to that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I liked Sun King only because I wanted to learn it on guitar, and I'm like, man, I want to learn this song because it sounds so neat. And it taught me this really weird chord that I was like, whoa, Beatles, what are you doing? Yeah, it's a lot of fun to play on guitar, so I guess I have a different love for it. But yeah, definitely the French in it. No one knows what they're saying. They're like, Malas calabusca, qui le go cat carousel. You're like, uh-huh.
It's weird, man.
So this song has hits.
The
has
whole thing is
all
big
the
hit.
Hits.
I mean, we had to kind of strain to pick out our least favorite song just because they're all good.
Well, like, straight up hits, I want to say between Come Together and Here Comes the Sun, those are probably the two biggest hits on the album.
Well, they did make a video out of Something. I think it was the only video for the album. And it took all four of the guys with their wives at the time.
Have you ever seen the music video for The Fool on the Hill? Not only is that an amazing song, but the video is like really, really 60s. Like, you watch it and you're like, whoa. They basically follow around Paul as he's dancing on a mountaintop and on a train with some
his
supermodel wife. Totally. So similar artists and albums.
You know, this album is titled Abbey Road because it was produced at Abbey Road. And I think that there's a huge selection of albums that we can talk about that were all produced at Abbey Road, and they all kind of have that Abbey Road feel in some way or another.
Do you think that they, in naming it Abbey Road and in the album cover they did it, they recorded Abbey Road. Abbey Road is a fantastic studio, state-of-the-art studio at the time, but do you think it was kind of a throwaway concept to call it Abbey Road and to take a picture on Abbey Road? Do you think it was them going like, we're musicians, we're recording at Abbey Road? It didn't really fit anything in the album. It's not like Revolver, which is about
the
tax man.
The album was going to be, it was going to be named for some big mountain, and they would have to go to the mountain to take a picture of it, and that was going to be the album cover. But they decided against that because nobody wanted to travel. They're all just like, all right, let's just get this album done with. So they said, let's just call it Abbey Road. And they had a photo session out front of Abbey Road for 30 minutes, and that's where the album cover came from.
Steve, what's sadder, the Beatles, this being the last time the Beatles recorded together and them eventually breaking up, or Blink-182?
I was a little heartbroken with Blink-182.
Like, who's a bigger loss in a group sense, Tom DeLonge or Paul McCartney? What do you think?
I don't know, man. You really asked some big questions here. Dude, don't... Don't mess with me like that. Obvious answer.
Like, I'm trying to put two and two together. And so similar artists. The only band that I ever think of when I think of the Beatles and I think of like a band that's like similar to me is ELO, Electric Light Orchestra.
I'm going to need you to back that up with some reasoning. Tell me the reason why you think that.
The reason I think of it is because they are all amazing singers. Their songs are all really, really melodic and composed in a very similar fashion to the Beatles. And they're all crazy about using violins and all kinds of horns and all kinds of stuff the way the Beatles were. That's my reasoning. And I know that Electric Light Orchestra actually really, really loved the Beatles and had like kind of an obsession with the Beatles. Yeah, but they took it to another, like, I mean, like, listen to, like, Telephone Line or something, and the Beatles could cover Telephone Line, and they would sound like a better version. But I think they're the most Beatles-sounding band that I think of, just because they could all sing. It's hard to sing, like, be a good singer and compose amazing music. Like, have more than one good singer in a band and compose amazing music.
Well, while we're on the subject of similar artists and albums, I just saw this movie Boyhood. Have you heard of that? Yeah.
Yes.
It's a great movie.
That's the one where it was the kid that, like, they recorded him over so many years.
Like, the movie starts out and he's, like, 8 years old or something. And then...
So much fucking patience. So much goddamn patience for a filmmaker.
Yeah, but it's amazing that every few years they get the entire cast back together and they shoot a few more scenes. And you actually watch this boy grow up from maybe 8 to 18 years old. And it's actually the same kid over 10 years. And his sister and his parents... But what's awesome about the movie is the soundtrack. Every single scene on there has a song that goes along with it. It fits the moment perfectly. And there's a few references to the Beatles on there. His dad makes him the Black Album, which is kind of like B-sides and stuff that didn't make it so popular. And yeah, his dad puts it together for him and explains to him, you know, there's a reason why the tracks are in this order. He put it together like...
I remember this movie now, and I liked it, but it had that kind of lackluster ending feel where you're like, oh, this is...
Yeah, it doesn't have the greatest... Yeah, it doesn't have the greatest plot.
But the story as it's going is actually... It's a very... Yeah, like his mom and his dad divorce, right? And his mom goes back to school. And I'm trying to ruin it for people, but it was... It was a very cool movie, and I remember it did have an excellent soundtrack.
There's one time where the kid's sitting in the car with his dad, and they're driving along, and Wilco's song is playing in the background, Sky Blue Sky. And his dad kind of,
awesome,
you know,
song.
Through a lot of the movie, his dad is kind of like giving him parental advice and, like, you know, tips on how to be a man and stuff. And they're listening to this Wilco song, and he's like, see, it's just basic country. Listen to that. And the production, it's like Abbey Road or something.
His dad is Ethan Hawke, and Ethan Hawke, I think, totally fits the mold of being a really irresponsible dad. I even doubt he's a good dad to his own kids.
Yep.
I could go as far as say.
But they make it a point to kind of reference Abbey Road when they're talking about Wilco's Sky Blue Sky.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Is that because it was recorded there or something?
It just has a similar production value to it. You know, Wilco... Has the right people playing on their tracks and has the right producers on it.
Every time you say Wilco, I think of that Wilco song that's like, Wilco, Wilco.
No.
You know that song? The Wilco loves you, baby. You never heard that song?
Okay,
oh, I got to find it for you. It's such a cool song because you know how you're like, you know, we did the thing on Shaka Khan and you're like, I love Shaka Khan because that song's like Shaka, Shaka Khan. And this is the same thing. Like every time I hear Wilco, I think of their song where they say Wilco over and over again. So you think Wilco has similar production value or similar to the Beatles? Wilco is a very, like, what's the deal with Wilco? Like, I don't, are they like, I don't know. Like, what are they like? Brian Adams type? Adult contemporary
with a country feel.
What the fuck does that mean? What does adult contemporary mean? Like anything that's contemporary
is
of the time.
It's like when you grow up, it's like not pop music. It's stuff that appeals to people who are just, you know, a little bit older than Poppy.
Not having sex regularly.
That's adult contemporary.
Adult contemporary. Well, very cool role over there into talking about Wilco. And so what was your, before we move on to This Week in Music History, what was your beef with ELO? Do you have any, do you think
they're
not
like the
Beatles?
No, I have no beef with them. I just don't know enough about them to make an informed decision.
Okay. Cool. That's a responsible thing. That's like, you know what, Steve? I instantly know you're more liberal than conservative when you say, I really don't have enough experience to surmise what the hell to say about it.
I can sit here and talk my ass off about ELO, but I'm going to sound like an idiot.
Well, not to throw politics into it, but with the recent events in Paris, which is heavy on everybody's minds and hearts, there's nothing but a storm of idiots who have all kinds of opinions when they have no idea what they're talking about. It's just completely out of their ass. Yeah, we should all just dig deeper. Dig deeper into humanity and stop being so
quick to judge. Didn't the Beatles say something about that once? Isn't that like what they're all about?
Yeah, pretty much. That's the difference between if music molds your life or if music is just is like an interruption in your life. If music is really something that you're all about, you should listen to it a little bit. It's more than just entertainment. It's entertaining, but it's more than entertainment. It's supposed to change the world, and the Beatles are all about changing the world.
So let's stay on the subject of the Beatles while we talk about some music history a little bit. If we go back to 1960, the Beatles played a show in Germany without George Harrison. It turns out he was deported on this day for being underage. He was only 17, and he wasn't legally allowed to remain in the nightclub after midnight. So he broke a few rules in Germany back in 1960. And because of that, I guess they had to find someone else to fill his place.
They just played without him, maybe. Who knows? Did they actually have a fill-in guitarist? That's interesting. If they had a fill-in guitarist, you know how much that sucks to play one gig with the Beatles?
Yep.
Like, I played one gig with the Beatles. Like, you would be like, I'm the guy who played one gig with the Beatles. Yep. They'd be like, oh, you just weren't good enough. Nice. And then in 1980, Don Henley was arrested after a naked 16-year-old girl was found at his home in Los Angeles suffering from a drug overdose. He received a $2,000 fine with two years probation.
What are you doing with naked 16-year-olds? And how did you get off with just a fine and two years probation? I think anyone else but Don Henley would have a much harsher sentence than that.
Yeah, what the hell is that? And that's something else. You know what though? The Eagles are all messed up because they had like a last tour, and then they had a second tour called Hell Freezes Over when their last tour had already gone through. It's just because they couldn't get away from playing Hotel California for the 500th.
That's another song
I'm
gonna put on
life.
The temporary hold list. We should put a 1 year ban on Hotel California at karaoke night. Just to let it come back and be fresh again a year from now. I think it's a little played out at this point.
It's a great song, but I don't know. I'm more about Life in the Fast Lane, which Don Henley was living back in 1980, apparently.
Well, in 1991, Aerosmith made their big animated debut on The Simpsons.
I remember that
the
episode.
Simpsons is pretty well known for having a bunch of guest stars on there, like the Chili Peppers, Smashing Pumpkins.
Wait, before we move past the Aerosmith, wasn't that the episode where, like, something happened to the city where they, like, took away the sun? Was this when they took away the sun and they held, like, a concert to break a wall down? I don't know. It was some kind of really, like, Aerosmith basically saved the day.
Mr. Burns tried to take over the sun?
Yeah, like, he made, like, a thing that covered the sun, which is hilarious in itself if you have any idea how the fucking sun works. You're not going to be able to block out the sun, douche. But he was able to do it because he has a lot of money and rich people.
That was not the Aerosmith episode.
Stuff. Oh, no.
Aerosmith appeared on the Flaming Moe's episode.
Flaming Moe's?
Moe's Tavern came up with his own drink and he'd light it on fire. This was The Simpsons' third season. It was actually Homer's idea, where Homer tells Moe of a secret cocktail that includes cough medicine and fire. And he calls it a Flaming Homer. And then Moe steals the recipe, calls it the Flaming Moe, and all of a sudden, everybody's showing up at his tavern. Everybody wants a piece of the Flaming Moe, including Aerosmith. And, you know, Moe's Tavern gets so big that he gets Aerosmith to play there for him.
Well, that's one episode that we'll quickly forget, because they had other people on there as well, other musicians. Steve, you mentioned the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I see U2 was on there. Wow, they had all these different bands. The Moody Blues. What the hell? That's insane. Well, the B-52s is funny because that one guy, he could be a character in The Simpsons, right? I'm out at a party and I'm running my car and then
I'd love really Shaq, like to see baby. The White Stripes episode of The Simpsons. That could be good.
That could be good. And in 1991, Freddie Mercury died of a complication from AIDS at his home in London's Holland Park, age 45. Man, I've been on a Freddie Mercury like binge as of late. That was just one day after admitted he was HIV positive. Mercury was openly bisexual and enjoyed a colorful rock star lifestyle. During his career with Queen, he scored over 40 top 40 UK singles, including the world number one, Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah, the music world lost a legend in 1991.
Years ago. No, 24 years ago.
Well, got it. Time machine, we're in 2005. That's really sad. I will say one weird thing, and I did hear something that in one of Queen's tours in Madison Square Garden, they had people giving blowjobs in the bathrooms, like
Madison
as part
Square
of
Garden
the show.
Hasn't changed all that much. I was just there last week. Got my blowjob in the bathroom.
All I know is that this week in Steve and Neil history, I believe either 4 or 5 years ago, I flew up to New York City and we saw Roger Waters' The Wall at Madison Square Garden. Life-changing, life-altering, a bit of the most intense stuff ever. I got to experience Madison Square Garden's tiny hallways as you between acts. And I'll never forget that guy in the bathroom who was screaming at the top of his lungs, "Bro, did you see the giant floating big man?" And then he was like, "I'm so high on acid." And everybody just started laughing like, "Who is this guy? Like, who? Whoa." Yeah, it was quite a show. Probably the best. I mean, that is the best live music show I've ever seen. Like, just
it wasn't even
production
a concert.
Value
it was a theatrical experience.
Yeah, the way that the bricks went up and you didn't even know, and when the whole stadium lights come on and there's just this giant wall standing in front of you, you could hear a collective gasp where it was like, what?
Yeah,
just like, what?
You know
what
it,
just
brick
happened?
By brick starts coming together and you're not even paying attention until all of a sudden the wall is complete.
Now let's go on to something that's not, I guess maybe it's equally as depressing as losing Freddie Mercury, was when the world gained this next song. Steve, why don't you go ahead and tell the world a little bit about the Venga Boys.
Yeah, the Venga Boys like to party, and they want everyone to know
they
like to party. And they like to tell everyone with the suckiest song ever made. It's called
We
Like to Party, or also known as the Venga Bus. And this song is the beginning of a wave of trash Eurodance music that started, I guess, in the mid-90s or so.
Swept the nation and really kind of swept music under the rug.
It swept the world. Somehow it reached number one in Belgium. I think it made it to the top 20 here in the U.S.,
because it reached number one in Belgium, can we blame it for the rise of Radical
surprised.
Islam?
I mean, the two producers for this song, I'm probably going to wreck their names, but it's Wessel van Diepen and Dennis van den Dreyfen. You put those names together and things are going to happen, man. They're not going to be good things.
Yeah, there's something going on here. You know, at first I'm like, what is this song, Venga Boys? And it was curious because when I looked them up, two men, two women called Venga Boys. I'm already confused. And then when the beat dropped, I'm like, oh, this song was like the number one cruise ship song of the 90s. This song is on par with that song that just keeps saying Waikiki Kiki over and over again.
With that.
You ever heard the song before? It's like Waikiki Kiki.
This song is on par
came out around the same time.
Barbie Girl.
Yeah, this is Aqua. This is Aqua.
It's got such a repetitive beat, and I think that's the part that gets me. It's over and over and over again. If they switch it up a little bit and make it sound not so sucky, maybe I'd be down with it. But you put it all together, and it's like just a perfect recipe for suck.
Yeah, this is on. This song is on some greatest hits dance songs of the 90s with Be My Lover and and Barbie Girl. Yeah, somewhere. Swimming with the Ethos. There's nothing good here. There's nothing good here. You shouldn't look it up. If you remember Venga Boys and you look it up, you're going to dance to it once and then you're going to regret
for the rest of the week and you won't be able to get it out. Just don't say we didn't warn you.
Yeah, it was just a mistake. I don't know why they overproduce sometimes music that's so terrible. Like, is it really necessary for them to make it sound extra robotic and crappy?
That's why they have to overproduce it, because if it wasn't so produced, it would sound even suckier than it already is.
Yeah, but like, you know, Taylor Swift is overproduced and she's not terrible like this. This is terrible. What were we doing in the 90s where we accepted this shit? Like, was it cool to be dancing?
Was it
like,
cool to
people
be dancing?
Just,
we were watching, like, Friends.
Like, you know?
X-Files.
Yeah, we started with Abbey Road, which is a time capsule of great music. And it seems like every one of these podcasts, we end on a little bit of a sad note. And that's really weird when the saddest thing on this podcast is Freddie Mercury passed away in 91, when the Venga Boys coming out with We Like to Party is not far behind. That is just time and a place. So Steve, how about a little unexpected question for you. You in the 90s were an adolescent. You were
some of my best
a teenager
times in the 90s, yeah.
In the 90s. I was not even like in high school yet. So what year out of the 90s would you say was the low point for you in popular music? If, like, do you recall maybe what grade you were in, or like what year you were just like, all right, I'm listening to a lot of good stuff, but I fucking can't believe how bad the radio is. Let me just move on.
And even at the time, I was a little too young to realize what was happening. But I think coming out of the 80s and finding the 90s was a difficult transition for a little while. 90, 91, it still had that super synth.
It still smelled, it still reeked of
80s. But then by the time
fish.
92 came around and grunge started taking over, people got back to real instruments. It wasn't all about, you know, keyboards and synths. It was about emotion in your music.
Well, that's good, because it's important that your music have feeling. I thought I'd throw that out there. So, that being said, maybe next week's Sucky Song of the Week will be from 1990 or 1991. We'll find something. There's something out there. So, Steve, with that being said, remember to subscribe, share, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at Bass Treble Pod. We love you. This will be our last recording before the Thanksgiving holiday. We're taking a week off, doing a little bit of an extra release Friday coming up. We have a bunch of backlog episodes to work on. It's really just me and Steve that does all this, so we don't want your money. We don't want your financial help. What we want is for you to listen and follow us and tell your friends about us. I want to thank everybody who's listening. Thanks, Mom, for listening. All right, Steve. Man, Steve, you're just a ball full of fun. Everybody, Steve is a good time. And if you're listening to this and you think Steve is a good time, buy him a drink. Like, listen to this and go, I got to go find Steve and buy him a drink.
We're not here for your money. We're not here for your drinks. Just like our page.
All right, well, see you next time, buddy.
Goodbye.
Have a happy Thanksgiving. Like, I'm not going to talk to you before then. Peace.
Wait. We'll be right back.